Today on Word of Mouth, we have been celebrating April Fool's Day with a deeper look into pranks, practical jokes, and hoaxes, and we wrap up with the mother of all deception, the con. But what sets a con apart from a hoax? Is it a desire for monetary gain, or perhaps an innate desire to deceive? And what role do we play in the con? To find out more about the intricate art and history of the con, we go to a conversation Virginia had with Amy Reading, author of The Mark Inside, A Perfect Swindle, A Cunning Revenge, and A Small History of the Big Con.
Well, let's go to the art of the con, which plays on some of the softest spots of human nature. But it was the term invented in America. Is it particularly an American phenomenon, the confidence trick?
Certainly, Americans have been fascinated with con artists for our entire history. I think you can see it as a kind of further evolution of another mythical figure in our culture, which is the self-made man. Mm. The con artist just takes that one step further and invents absolutely everything about himself. But I would point out that it's not only American. There are other nations and other cultures that are fascinated with this figure, and I think the thing that they all have in common is that they're market cultures. And it does stretch back, you know, as far back as early modern Europe, when this question of attaining the price of something, attaining the value of something, became a question of cultural importance, and that stretched even to the value of a person and who is the person that's standing in front of you.
And the very origins of this republic, founding father Thomas Jefferson had a strong distaste for speculation or a market based on anything but actual goods and services or debt. That was a prime target of Benjamin Franklin. Risk and debt, you know, both at the heart of American capitalism. How did they play into the confidence trick?
Originally, you're right, Jefferson and Franklin were very much in favor of labor and earning what you spend from what you grow and having everything be local networks of trade. And this was a very hard-fought debate at that time, and they essentially lost, although it took a long time, well into the 19th century, before we had a federal bank and a central banking system based on federally issued debt that you can buy and sell and trade. And all of this was seen as a way to encourage speculation and encourage people to make fortunes based on nothing, to trade paper rather than to grow crops and to transport them over local networks of trade. But once you've got fortunes that exist only on paper, then you can counterfeit them. You can trade them in all sorts of different ways that manipulate the value there. Then you're dealing with a system of trade that's based on trust. And it's based on authority and the markers of those authority, which is very different from looking at a bushel of wheat and weighing it and coming up with a price.
Before there was a national currency, there was exchanging banknotes. It was sort of like exchanging an IOU. So how did confidence men take advantage of that?
Oh, every possible way you can imagine. Each bank would issue essentially its own currency, and it would all look very, very different. Therefore, it was extremely easy to counterfeit because one person couldn't possibly memorize every single banknote and every single signifier of authority. So people would counterfeit notes, and then in order to address this problem, other people would publish counterfeit detectors, which would reproduce what the actual note from each bank looked like so that you could pull out a bill from your wallet and hold it up to the counterfeit detector and see if the note that you're holding in your hand matches. And if it matches, then you've got an actual note and not a fake one. But, of course, then you can just go ahead and counterfeit the counterfeit detector. And
I love that.
You keep spinning the wheel and manipulating the signs of authority. And so there's no bottom. It's this sort of infinite regress. And this is a huge problem at a time when, you know, no one in the North would know banks from the South and vice versa. The country was very far apart in terms of cultural and geographic distance.
In a way, it's just American ingenuity at work, isn't it?
Well, yes, it is. And you know what? We have always kind of admired con men. We condemn them and we don't want to be their victims. Yet we hold them up as cultural heroes in a lot of our stories and our myths because they're clever and because they see opportunities where other people don't. They're entrepreneurs, really, and they are very good at making use of the disparity between the laws and the opportunities that exist where laws have not yet moved in. And that's called, you know, just plain old good business sense. So it can sometimes be hard to keep in mind that, oh, no, they're actually criminals, but they're very good ones. They're very smart.
But what's interesting about all these cons throughout history that you detail is using the tools, technologies, and norms of the time, right? The railroads, for example, provided an escape for people. And in this time of criminal masterminds, taking advantage of even wiretapping. Now, this I found fascinating. How did swindlers get into intercepting messages?
Well, so first, swindlers actually did intercept wiretaps from racetracks. This is a kind of gambling swindle where they would intercept the results of a horse race before it got to a betting parlor, delay it by just a few minutes so then they could place bets on the actual winning horse, and then relay the results. And what do you know? They won. So they did this for a while and made lots of money and made lots of pool room and saloon operators much poorer. But then, as swindlers do, they turned it around once again and made it a little bit deeper. They began selling, if you will, the idea of tapping racing betting parlors, and where they didn't even have to tap the wires anymore. They could pretend they could have a set with all these complicated boxes and wires and dials where it looked like they were tapping the racetracks. And they would then persuade a mark that they had this incredible technology, this money-making mechanism, and they would get the mark to invest on setting up a betting parlor where they could take money from other marks through this magical means. And these dials and wires would lead nowhere. It was all just a front. But they had proven in the past, by actually tapping racetracks, that they could do it. So there was no reason for a mark not to invest in the idea of perpetrating this con on other people. So you just see how the swindlers can take each idea they have and take it one step further.
Virginia speaking with Amy Reading, author of The Mark Inside, A Perfect Swindle, A Cunning Revenge, and A Small History of the Big Con.